2 Samuel 2 goes like this. In the course of time, David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up to one of the towns of Judah?" he asked. The Lord said, "Go up." David asked, "Where shall I go?" "To Hebron," the Lord answered. So David went up there with his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel, and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. David also took the men who were with him, each with his family, and they settled in Hebron and its towns. Then the men of Judah came to Hebron, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. When David was told that it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who had buried Saul, he sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead to say to them, "The Lord bless you for showing this kindness to Saul your master by burying him. May the Lord now show you kindness and faithfulness, and I too will show you the same favor because you have done this. Now then, be strong and brave, for Saul your master is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over them." Meanwhile, Abner, son of Ner, the commander of Saul's army, had taken Ishbosheth, son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. He made him king over Gilead, Ashuri, and Jezreel, and over Ephraim, Benjamin, and all Israel. Ishbosheth, son of Saul, was 40 years old when he became king over Israel, and he reigned 2 years. The house of Judah, however, followed David. The length of time David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. Last weekend, summer arrived, and this weekend seems to have gone. But at least the daffodils are still out. There is the promise of summer. There is the expectation that summer is coming, even though the temperature has dropped 10 degrees since last Sunday. In our lives, God sometimes seems to be answering our prayers, and summer seems to be arriving. God's kingdom seems to be coming in our lives and in our experience. We seem to be being victorious as we serve him. That seems to be happening, but sometimes there are setbacks. Sometimes there are delays. Sometimes there are partial victories. Then they're not quite what we expected, what we anticipated. And I wonder how you are when that happens to you. I wonder how you cope with that. The partial victories, the mismatch between your expectation and what actually happens. Seems to be summer, but it's raining again. It's blowing again. It's cold again. Saul is dead. Jonathan is dead. Israel have been roundly defeated. The Philistines are occupying the cities in the north of the town, the nation of Israel. Bodies have been buried. David has mourned. He has said how the mighty are fallen. David seems to have no sense of delight over the death of Saul. He mourns over it. But at the end of this time of silent grief, it's as though David looks up and says to God, "What shall I do now? Is it time? Is it now? Is it now? Is the kingdom going to be now? Is it going to happen now? What shall I do? Shall I go up to one of the towns of Judah?" Judah is in the south. Judah is where people would have known David best. "Shall I go up to one of the towns of Judah?" And God says, "Yes." "Where?" David says. And God says, "Hebron." Not quite as famous to us, perhaps, as Bethlehem. Not quite as famous as Jerusalem. Bear in mind, Jerusalem hasn't yet been conquered by the people of Israel. But God tells him to go up to Hebron. Famous in Israelite history, though. It's the place where Abraham journeyed through, built an altar to the Lord, and then later said, "This is where I want to bury my wife and for me to be buried, my wife Sarah to be buried there and for me to be buried there." Hebron is the place where Isaac and later Jacob lived. Hebron is the city and the area that was given to Caleb, a colleague of Jacob, the two guys who, the good spies who went into the land and saw that God could help them win. So it's not an insignificant city in Bible history, a city really of promise. Remember, Abraham was journeying and he got to Hebron and he built an altar to the Lord as God made him more promises. And he buried Sarah there as a kind of an anticipation of the promise. So Hebron is a great city of promise. And I'm sure David worked that out. It's a great city of promise. Promise made, maybe promise partially realized because Sarah's buried there and Abraham's buried there, but it's not completely realized. So it's a great place for David to be. And the men of Judah, the tribe of Judah, they make David their king. They anoint him king. And in some ways, it seems a bit of an anticlimax, you know. We've been going all the way through this book, after the first few chapters, thinking about David and the possibility that he'll become king and so on. And now he becomes king of Judah. Just a verse on it, really, and a verse on how long it goes on for. But that's what happens. And David, as king of Judah, he hears about what had happened to do with Jabesh-Gilead. The men of Jabesh-Gilead, in what we looked at last week from chapter 31, verses 8 through 12, you can see it there, that Saul had been, and his son Jonathan had been kind of put up as trophies, in a particular place in Philistine territory, and the men of Jabesh-Gilead had gone and rescued those bodies. They'd marched through the night, and with great bravery and fortitude, they'd gone and grabbed these bodies, and they'd taken them away and buried them properly. And David praises them for their faithfulness, for their loving kindness to the house of Saul, and he prays that God will bless them in a similar way, and he offers to them that he will be kind in a similar way to them. And he says, be strong, be brave in this time of great uncertainty. That's what he says to them. We don't have a clue what they say to him. It seems as though they don't actually respond positively, because the next thing we hear about is that the north, the northern area of Israel, is eventually reigned over by this guy called Ish-bosheth. Ish-bosheth is one of the sons of Saul. He hasn't been mentioned before, and he doesn't really get mentioned at all after this chapter. You would have thought that Saul's army and Saul's sons would have figured out what's going on, that they must have been aware, as Abner was, that all these promises have been made to David, but don't underestimate the desire people have to hold on to power. You can see this politically all the time. People just grasp onto power, like Mugabe was in Uganda and so on. People just want to grab hold of power, even though maybe the writing's on the wall and it's time for them to go. And Abner's a bit like that. Abner is a kind of a king maker. He's the commander of the army, so of course he could really decide what to do, and a little bit later he does decide to do something different. But for this moment, he says, let's make Saul's son king. And eventually, maybe after some fighting and enlisting people from the various tribes, he pretty much gets Ish-bosheth to be king over the northern part of Israel. So you've got David in the south, in Judah, and you've got Ish-bosheth with the commander of the army, Abner, in charge in the north. It seems as though that takes a lot longer for Ish-bosheth, so it says that he only reigned for 2 years as king, whereas David reigns for 7 years in Judah before the events that follow that and all changes. So I guess Ish-bosheth took a lot longer, kind of conquering those cities again, maybe recapturing from the Philistines and so on. Abner does realize too late the side that he needs to be on. He's already had encounters with God's providence and with David, but he doesn't realize at this point who truly should be king. What can we learn then from this? First of all, we can see David as a believer, and we see him patiently waiting on the timing of God. David had probably spent about 10 years running away from Saul. He's still pretty much a young man, but he's experienced things that most of us will never experience, even at this young age. So 10 years or more that he'd been on the run, and here that the moment almost arrives. It almost arrives. It seems that it is the time that he's going to become king, but he doesn't become king over all Israel yet. And he moves very slowly, very carefully, very dependently on God. And he doesn't get what he expects to get, perhaps, all at once. We know if you look at 1 Chronicles 22, the book of Chronicles sort of parallels the books of Samuel and Kings. But in the book of Chronicles, we know that lots of warriors came to join David here as he is king. So he certainly had a sufficient fighting force that I reckon he could have conquered the whole of Israel. But he doesn't choose to do that quite yet. And even in the next section we're going to look at next week, he doesn't seem to be really involved in the fights that go on there. He is patient, waiting for the timing of God. He's got to wait another 7 years. He might be quite a young man, but he's going to be 7 years older. He's learned something in all that time in the wilderness, running away from Saul. He's learned something about himself, something about God. He's learned that he has to wait and that God has to act and God has to decide when it's time. He doesn't make the decisions. He doesn't make the schedule. It's God who makes the schedule. It's God who's in charge of timing. He needs to learn like Abraham had to learn. Here he is, burying his wife in Hebron in anticipation that the people would be there. Earlier in Abraham and Sarah's life, they'd had to wait a long time, maybe 25 years, for the son that was promised to them. All the time it's seeming to get further and further away as a possibility. Think about the nation of Israel. How long were they in Egypt? 430 years. Not all of that in slavery, but a lot of that time in slavery. Waiting, waiting. When is God going to act? When is God going to release us? Surely he's with us. Who's in charge of the agenda? Who's in charge of the schedule? So David is patient. But not only is he patient, he's also prayerful and obedient to the word of God. David doesn't just wait. He asks God for help. He inquires of God. You remember that he has at least one of the priests with him and the ephod and the Urim and Thummim in which he could ask questions and God would answer in that period of time. God was answering the people in that way with yes, no answers. And so he asks and he receives answers from God. He receives guidance from God. And I'm sure as well as praying specifically those questions, if you think about the whole book of Psalms, many of which are written by David, I'm sure right through that time he was prayerful too. He wasn't just saying specifically about this question. I'm sure those specific questions were as a result of his life of prayer, his life of pleading with God and praying to God and saying, what would you like me to do? Where would you like me to go? I see your promises. I see that I'm anointed king, but it hasn't happened yet. And I've still got enemies. Saul and Jonathan have gone. Jonathan was my friend. Saul was really my enemy. And he's gone now. But Saul's other son is on the throne. And he's my enemy. And they don't want me to be king over Israel. Lord, what's happening? I'm sure he was praying stuff like that, don't you think? And he prays and he asks God, so what shall I do? Is it time? Shall I go up to Judah? Shall I go? And God says yes, and so he obeys. He obeys exactly what God says, and he obeys in a very comprehensive way. It doesn't just take himself and a couple of mates to Hebron just to kind of stake it out. It says he took everybody with him, took all his army, took all the families, all the guys who just settled in Ziklag and they'd been plundered and taken away and he'd rescued them. We heard about that a couple of weeks ago. And he brought them all back and got them all settled there and they'd put the wallpaper up and decorated and redone their kitchens and everything else. And now it's time to move again. So here we go, we've got to move again all the way to Hebron. Oh, you lot have got to move. This big caravan of people coming on their way to Hebron. Because comprehensively, completely, David trusts God. So he says, I'm going to do just what you say. I'm going to go and take everybody to Hebron. I'm going to plant my feet here and see what God's going to do next. How are you with the idea of patiently, prayerfully, obediently, waiting for the timing of God? I'm not really talking about what's your general disposition. Some of us are more patient than others. I was shopping yesterday in Sainsbury's, doesn't happen very often, but I'm the sort of so impatient person that if Caroline goes off to get something, I can't wait in an aisle, I have to be on the move. So I sort of started moving back to her, and she's going, she said, "You're going in the wrong way." I said, "I know, but I can't stay where I am. I've got to be keep moving with the trolley. I've got to come, even though I'm going in the wrong direction, I've got to feel like there's some progress. I'm that impatient. You know, if a bus or a taxi or a train is there, I've got to do something in that time." I'm not talking about that kind of disposition, which may be helpful sometimes and may other times be very unhelpful. I think you know that. But I'm not really talking about that kind of patience. I'm talking about the patience that we need when God doesn't give us what we want and what he seems to have promised. When things don't work out how we want them to or when we want them to. You don't need to be a Christian very long to face that kind of trial, that temptation that says, God seems to have promised this, but it doesn't seem to be happening yet. We see God's promises to always be with us. We see God's promises to help and to heal. And God seems to be answering those prayers, but then it fades. The sun goes in. Things seem to be coming together in an organized way, and there seems to be an answer, but then it's snatched away from us. And that causes us painful doubts at times. Are God's promises going to be fulfilled? And of course, the response to that is to lurch in one direction or the other. The one direction we can lurch in is to take the law into our own hands and say, well, God doesn't seem to be fulfilling his promises, so I better do it. That's one extreme. Of course, the other extreme is just to do nothing and for our faith to just wither. And what God calls us to do is to wait patiently, prayerfully, obediently. Obedient to what God has revealed up to this point. Now, God hasn't promised us answers like David. He hasn't promised us yes, no answers that we can apply to God and say, shall I apply for that job? Yes, no. He hasn't given us, in our day, in the gospel age, he hasn't given us that option. But we do have the full revelation that is there in Jesus Christ in the Bible. We do have God's promises to hear our prayer and to answer abundantly more than we can ask or imagine. And we do have the promise that God is building his kingdom and nothing will prevail against it, not even hell itself. And we do have the promise that God will guide us in all kinds of ways, primarily through his word, but also through his people, through circumstances that come our way, through our own inclination, and as he helps us to interpret our circumstances, God guides us. He's promised to do that. And God calls us with that to wait, to ask, to listen, to obey. We are working so hard, I think, at the moment in evangelism. We are trying so hard to explain to people the gospel, to tell people the gospel, to create opportunities where people can hear the gospel. We're trying so hard, and we know that God is building his kingdom, and we know that God doesn't desire anyone to perish, but that all would be saved. So pleading his promises, we say, Lord, please save many people. Every week, through this particular mission coming up, we plead with God to save. And sometimes it looks like something's going to happen. We get quite a lot of people along to this or that, and there seems to be a lot of spiritual interest, but then it seems to wither a bit. What do we do? What do? We give up, or we say, well, we better just beat them up into becoming Christians. We better come up with some better arguments. We better bribe them to being Christians. We better do something to take it into our own hands, or we give up. What we need to do is keep trusting God's promises that he will build his church in the way that he wants and in the time that he wants, and in the meantime, be obedient to what he has revealed to us at this point, which is be gospel tellers and expect fruit. That's what God tells us, and we need to be faithful in those times when the daffodils are out, but summer hasn't arrived. And sometimes there are other situations that we need that. Maybe you're praying for healing from a particular troubled circumstances, a troubled illness, and sometimes God will hear those prayers. And sometimes those prayers will be heard and will only be healed when we get to heaven. What's our duty Sometimes God only partially hears those prayers, that there is a healing that happens of a circumstance or an illness. There is a healing, but it's partial, it's not complete. We're still waiting for the full kingdom joy of being fully healthy and happy. We're still waiting for that. How do we wait? We wait patiently, we wait prayerfully, we wait obediently. It's not easy, is it? That's why we've got Bible texts like this that give us great examples to say, this is hard. This wasn't easier for David, you think? You think he wasn't a bit impatient, thinking, I waited so long, 10 years or more? But he waits patiently and prayerfully. And of course, while David's been waiting, we've been benefiting. And while David's been waiting, David's been benefiting. Do you think David learned anything over those 10 years? I reckon he did. Do you think David recorded some psalms over that period? Of course he did. We know that. Psalms for our benefit. Psalms that express his greater intimacy with God. And that's what happens. As we patiently, prayerfully wait, we get closer to God. It drives us to God, to trust in him more, to pray to him more, to inquire of him more, to wonder, Lord, what are you doing? What should I do? Where should I go? We get to know God better in these times of waiting and adversity. Take that opportunity. Are you praying and are you waiting for something? Is there something particular you're praying for? Is it just the coming of God's kingdom in the world that you're waiting for? Pray, but be obedient to what God's revealed to you and say, this is a great opportunity to get to know God better. Not to abandon my faith, but to strengthen my faith and be strengthened in the Lord. So David, as a believer, is such a great example to us of a believer who's trusting and waiting patiently. But also he points us to Jesus, the ideal king. We've kept seeing that as we've worked through David, and we'll continue to see that. David's only a man. David makes lots of mistakes, even before some of the bigger mistakes that are coming up. But at key moments, David, as king, shows us glimpses, sometimes a big canvas picture of the greater king, Jesus. And as David rises to power gradually, and at times imperceptibly, the son of David, Jesus, is set up in his kingdom by degrees. And now, at this moment, what is the status of Jesus? He is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. He is the Messiah. That's the status of Jesus. But do we see everybody subject to Jesus? Everybody bowing the knee to Jesus? Everybody acknowledging the kingship of Jesus? Do we? Go to the Orchard Shopping Centre and ask, do you bow the knee to Jesus? Not many. So there is a sense in which the kingdom hasn't come yet. But Jesus is victorious. So he points us to Jesus in that sense. He points us to Jesus in showing all those characteristics that Jesus would show. Did Jesus show prayerful, patient obedience? Of course he did. He was patient with his disciples as they were so ignorant and slow to grasp everything. He was patient on the timing of God as he had to grow up in this world and live in this world and be despised and rejected and misunderstood. He's patient with the timing of God, that it's not the time yet, it's not the time yet, and now it is the time. He's patient and prayerful and obedient. God reveals to him that he has to go to the cross, that he's the suffering servant from Isaiah. He's obedient to that and prayerful as he goes, trusting that the kingdom is coming, trusting that God is building his kingdom. He's the supreme, patient, prayerful, obedient one as he submits to the Father's will and says, this is the right time. This is God's timing. This is God's schedule. Now I'm going to die. Now is the time. And I will rise again. And I will go to be with the Father in glory. And then I will build my church. And I will build my church. And then one day I will return again. And it's not my schedule. It's the Father's schedule. He expresses that in saying, not even the Son knows. And we find that a bit mysterious. But it's expressing that submission the Son has to the Father. To say the Father's in charge of timing. Jesus, great example of prayerful, patient obedience. But of course, Jesus is such a great example to us of abundant kindness. I wonder why we have that little bit about David and the men of Jabesh-Gilead. Maybe it's to say he's pretty politically astute, isn't he? Trying to get these people in the north to follow him, but I don't think he needed to do that for that reason. I think he genuinely wanted to respect, to acknowledge their kindness and to pray for them that they would receive God's kindness and to offer his kindness to them. The word that's used there for kindness, loving kindness, it's that great Bible word. We thought about it a little bit when we were in the book of Ruth, the word hesed, the great loving kindness, Old Testament idea of showing favor, of being kinder to people than they deserve, and of being faithful in that kindness. And David's saying, you showed a glimpse of that. May God show you that, and I'm going to show you that, that loving kindness. I'm graciously making an invitation to you. Look, I've become king over Judah. I want to show you kindness. And it seems as though they spurn that offer. Jesus wants to show us loving kindness. I was reminded of some great words that Jesus utters in Matthew 11, where he says, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Jesus as King, the true King, makes lots of gracious invitations to us, like that one, to come to him and to find rest, to make him king. And he will show favor to us. He will show kindness to us, just like David was offering to those people. And David makes that loving invitation to you this morning. Many of you have received that invitation and you're enjoying that invitation. You're living lives of prayer and obedience, but some of you have not. Some of you are like those people of Jabesh-Gilead who have many virtues, many good things that you might have done, but you're not recognizing yet the true king and saying, I want the true king to show me kindness. This morning is a great morning to say, I've heard again this gracious invitation from Jesus. Jesus says, come to me, give up on trying to save yourself, acknowledge your sin, come and put your trust in me and I'll be your king. And I'm the forever king. Jesus says that to you again this morning. What are you going to do about it? Are you going to be like the people in the north? I'm not sure. Maybe I'll stick with Saul's son. Maybe I'll stick with what I know. Or are you going to say, yeah, it's time. It's time. It's time to come over. It's time to come over and acknowledge the true king, Jesus. Just like these guys should have acknowledged the true king, David, at that point. This morning is a great morning to do that, to say, I've made up my mind now. I'm going to follow the true King Jesus because he has made so many gracious invites to me. And here's another one this morning. Come on, receive God's grace in Jesus, the true King. So David's a great believer, but he's a great example to us of what Jesus is like. Building his kingdom patiently and prayerfully, prayerful and obedient through his life, but making gracious entreaties, gracious invitations. And of course, all of that inviting, like it was for David, is in a context of some opposition and some unbelief. The people in the north don't immediately join with David, and we'll read about that next time. But David, just like Jesus, isn't immediately recognized despite these gracious words and despite the obvious credentials. So church, don't be so surprised that we're in the not yet of everyone bowing the knee to Jesus, that not everyone will recognize King Jesus. Just like the north at this point, the north of Israel doesn't recognize, not the north of England. There are many saints in the north of England. But just like the north of Israel doesn't yet recognize David as king, there are people who we make the gracious invitation to them and they say, maybe, don't know really. That's what these people seem to do. They seem to be undecided. That is the context. Despite David's obvious credentials, so obvious to us, isn't it? They should have pledged their allegiance to David. And it's so obvious to us that people should pledge their allegiance to Jesus. Why wouldn't you follow Jesus? He is the King of Kings. It all makes sense. It all adds up. It makes sense of the world we live in. It makes sense. The Bible makes sense to us. It makes sense of all our experience. It's obvious. But still, we're living in a context where people are not all recognizing King Jesus. But they will. As the one who defeats and judges them, or as the one who is their true king. And our job, until everyone gets to that point of being judged by Jesus as those who've rejected him, or welcomed by Jesus as those who've accepted him, until that day comes, we are to be patient, prayerful, obedient.